supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we got one of those jam-packed shows for you again today, cats and kittens. In the question of the week, that's jammed enough. We're going to answer three separate questions about the effects of this miserable winter on plants and even pest insects. We're also going to interview Miriam Goldberg, author of a new book called Taming Wildflowers, about nature's most beautiful blooms. That's a lot to do, so we better hop right to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Carolyn, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
I am doing just fine. Caroline. And where are you, Caroline?
Well, I'm in Swedesboro, New Jersey.
What can we do for Caroline in Swedesboro, New Jersey?
I wanted to just kind of give a heads up to maybe some do-it-yourselfers that might have listened to your maple syrup sap boiling information. It was a show back in the beginning of February.
Right. Tyler Arboretum, local arboretum here in Media, PA, every year does this big maple sugaring celebration where they show people how they tap trees and boil down the syrup, and then you get to eat pancakes with real maple syrup and sausage.
Yeah, good idea.
Yeah, this is a sausage winter, you know.
Well, the only problem with it is, for anybody who's never boiled maple sap, it can be a mess. I have a story for you.
We always like gardening disaster stories. Are you kidding? That's the that's the central theme of this show.
I have to give my mother-in-law, Evelyn, you know, a little, banner for this story. We were in northern Pennsylvania, where we often buy maple syrup, northern tier, Susquehanna County. And we stopped at this little maple place where we always get the syrup. And she was reminiscing, and I was saying, oh, you know, I would really love to do that. I love to see all the lines. They had plastic lines going from tree to tree to collect the sap. And so she was explaining how all that happened and how you get the sap. And she said, but don't try this at home. And I said, well, why not? And she said, I was a teenager, and I got this idea that I would tap some trees and boil, you know, just a little sap, just enough for a couple of breakfasts for the family. And she boiled the sap. Her wallpaper peeled off of the walls, and the steam turns into sticky maple syrup right on your walls and on your ceiling and on evidently everything. I'm surprised her eyelids weren't glued shut. But anyway, it joined me from, you know, she said that's why there are sugar shacks where they boil the syrup down, because you can't do it evidently in your kitchen.
Absolutely right. That's one of the few classic gardening mistakes that I have managed to avoid. I have heard stories about people who have tapped the trees on their property for the first year. They're so proud of themselves. They got like a gallon of this watery sap, and they decide they're going to cook it down inside because nobody warned them not to. And then,
and then
God forbid that they liked that wallpaper, because you're correct. That's what I've heard, is it just comes pouring right off the wall.
Well, and she said it takes a great deal of sap before you ever get the syrup.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you just have to boil and boil and boil and boil and boil.
It's like you start with 10 gallons to get a quart of what we would call true maple syrup. And so, yes, you're correct. It's generally, it's always done outside, and that is where that song came from and where that expression came from. That's the sugar shack, the sugar house. And you would have a little wood fire out there. Maybe you'd be double boiling it. Maybe you'd be doing something like that. But yes, this is something that is done outside. Hey, kids, don't try this yourself at home.
Well, I just thought, oh my gosh, I kept listening and listening and thinking, oh, they're going to say, you know, have just a little do not do this in your house. And I didn't hear it, and I thought, oh, my gosh, you know, better make the call. Hopefully somebody is listening.
Well, thank you, because you're absolutely correct. It is something I should have added, but, you know, you always forget something. And hopefully there may be somebody putting a pot on their stove right now who's thinking twice about it. Take it outside. Do it on a camp stove, anything but
right.
Inside.
It's a little early. It's a little early, too,
so
I don't think the sap is rising quite yet, particularly in the northern tier.
I know I'm not. Yeah. All right, Carolyn, a well-timed warning. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. Thank you for taking my call. You have a great day.
You too. Thanks.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Joanne, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, Mike. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Joanne. How are you?
I'm doing great. You doing all right?
I'm doing okay. I'm holding my own. Where is Joanne doing great?
I'm in Crawfordville, Florida.
And where is Crawfordville? What part of Florida? Florida's a big place.
Yeah, that's just south of Tallahassee.
Okay, what can we do for Joanne in Crawfordville?
Well, I've been hearing about adding rock phosphate and green sand to your tomato planting hole. And I was just wondering what your opinion on that was. I also have been reading that it's good to put an aspirin like 6 inches away from the plant, molasses. So I was just wondering what your thoughts were on putting any of that into the hole, and at what time do I need to do that?
Well, those are all very different things. I thought I'd heard them all. I've never heard the aspirin. But I've also never had a tomato tell me it had a headache, so I'm not sure I would how I would handle that. The molasses sounds like my good friend Howard Garrett, who does a gardening show under the name of the Dirt Doctor down in Texas. Howard is a fool for molasses. He absolutely loves it. And I think it's also helping keep fire ants out of gardens. Howard told me recently that spreading sugar, just plain cane sugar or molasses around the garden, makes it unattractive to fire ants. And I know you have those in your region. I'm not quite sure. He and I don't necessarily agree on the sugary thing, but there's an old saying in our business as well. The only thing two gardeners agree on is that the third gardener is wrong. So I love Howard because he's totally organic, and we're always going to have different tricks and techniques. Now, it's very hip that you're thinking about adding rock phosphate and green sand, but these are not minerals that you would add to the tomato planting hole because they take a long time to become bioavailable, and they stay available to plants for 3 to 5 years after you use them. It's just the opposite of like a nitrogen fertilizer. Nitrogen fertilizers, because the air we breathe is mostly nitrogen, they're always getting lost in the air. So nitrogen is very ephemeral. But phosphorus and potassium are much more stable elements. And when you add them to a garden about 6 months later, that soil is very rich in natural phosphorus and potassium, but it doesn't act right away, and it doesn't need to be in the planting hole. Now, are you planting your tomatoes in the soil, in containers, raised beds, flat earth?
No, I've got raised beds.
Good, good, good. And you're rotating them around, the tomatoes?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Both these materials, both these organic materials, rock phosphate and green sand, a little bit goes a long way. So what I would do is I would buy a bag of each. And how big are your raised beds? Are they the typical 4x8?
Yes, they are.
I would put like a cup of each over the entire raised bed. And then to activate that material, I would cover it with compost or real high-quality topsoil. That's very important. if you just pour these things on the surface of the soil, they're just going to sit there. But to get them to become bioactive the quickest, you want to cover them with more soil, especially lively soil. If you cover rock phosphate and green sand, and, you know, we're talking just a sprinkling here, if you think about how far a cup or two would go in a 4x8 raised bed, and that's more than enough. These are very powerful natural fertilizers. But if you, when you cover them with compost, the little living organisms in the compost really start releasing those nutrients. So you'll start to see the benefits, which is better root development and more fruits and more flowers, within a couple of months. Next year, you won't believe the difference. That's when it'll be fully blown. Even 6 months from application in your environment, you'll see tremendous differences. But you'll continue to see that exceptional root growth and that maximum amount of flowering and fruiting for 3 to 5 years after you put it down. It's not something you have to do every year. It lasts a long time.
Okay, you're always so helpful. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. You take care.
Okay, you too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I'll be one of several special guests at the 10th annual Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, a fundraiser for the Philadelphia area community of Mount Airy at the historic Sedgwick Theater next Saturday evening, March 14th. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with lots more of your fabulous phone calls, how to handle winter-damaged plants, and nature's favorite flowers. I'm nature's favorite flower, Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Burpee supports You Bet Your Garden. Burpee can help do the gardening for you with garden-ready plants, tomatoes, peppers, eggplants, herbs, and more, delivered at planting time in your region. These and more can be seen online at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, winter-damaged plants. How do you assess them? Can these plants be saved? And is there any silver lining to this wretched winter that most of us have had to endure? We'll let you know when we get to the question of the week. We'll also take lots more of your fabulous phone calls. But now it's time to welcome our special guest, Miriam Goldberger, author of the new book, Taming Wildflowers, Bringing the Beauty and Splendor of Nature's Blooms into Your Own Backyard, from St. Lynn's Press. Miriam, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you very, very much, Mike.
Now, you have a wildflower farm that is called Wildflower Farm, and it's up in the wilds of Canada somewhere, right?
Yes, Canada, that's what we call it. And yes, it's about an hour and a half north of Toronto, and it's about 100 acres of wildflowers. It's very unpleasant. It's very stressful. You wouldn't like it at all.
You seem to say in your book that you were somehow seduced by these flowers at a very young age.
Well, I've been very interested in growing flowers for a very long time. And I got involved with wildflowers really almost by accident. It was really purely a business relationship at first. I had the first pick-your-own flower farm in Canada, and I had acres of flowers to tend to. These were all high-maintenance annuals and high-maintenance perennial hybrid, very, very cool stuff. And a lot of back in the 80s, we did a lot of everlastings as well. And I needed some flowers just for show in the front of the funky little barn shop that we'd built. And I needed something that was very low maintenance and that was perennial, and research indicated wildflowers. And so I put them in, and then people kept asking about this garden. You know, could I build this garden for them? Could I at least buy the plants if I wouldn't build a garden for them? And one thing really led to another. It wasn't what I ever intended to do. I got into it backwards, really, into wildflowers, and then I found out that they were amazing cut flowers, and I just fell in love with them because they were so extraordinarily beautiful, and I got really indignant once I really understood the range of species and thought, well, why don't people know about these extraordinary flowers and native grasses?
I think probably just as you say, because most people plant them as an afterthought when they, quote, don't have time to put in proper flowers. They just throw these things or some seeds in the ground. And with the inherent knowledge that these things have been around longer than most other things, they're better at taking care of themselves. And then, like Solomon in all his glory, they tend to show us that they might be the prettiest girls on the block.
Yes, in fact, that is the case. And you know, when I started growing wildflowers, no one was talking about, no one was even using the word environment or ecology or organic, except probably you. but most people thought that was a really obscure, offbeat idea. You know, bees were bad back in the day. You know, they were to be feared. And of course, lately, everyone's very, very worried about pollinators, and particularly the European bees. And lo and behold, wildflowers end up being the solution because they've been evolving with the native pollinators for, gosh, tens of thousands of years.
That was one of those pleasant surprises going through your book. I am a huge fan of native bees, and have
yes.
been protecting them and defending them and talking them up. And I'm so glad you're on at this time of year, because this is an opportunity to give one of several annual warnings I'll give, that if all of a sudden your front lawn or your flower beds are alive with these ground nesting bees, that these are not yellow jackets, they don't have stingers, they're not going to hurt you. They belong here. They've been here longer than you have. And if you just enjoy this raucous show that they put on for a short period of time, they'll go away and you'll have a more beautiful protrusion of flowers than you've ever had before. But let's talk about what you consider your best wildflowers, because you are obviously a real fan of them and you've devoted this entire book to them. So talk a little bit about some of your favorites.
I would have to say, I'll start with the familiar. There are so many beautiful, truly native echinaceas or coneflowers that I absolutely adore. There's the classic purple coneflower. There's also the Ozark coneflower or Echinacea paradoxa, which looks like a cartoon with a giant, giant seed head like a porcupine and big honking yellow petals. And it's very tall and kind of gawky. It looks kind of adolescent. And it blooms a really long time in the middle of the summer. And I love it. And then there's a Tennessee coneflower, or Echinacea tennesseensis. And it's an unusual echinacea because it has flat petals. Instead of drooping down like all the other coneflowers, the petals are flat, even possibly tilting upward in a dish-like or saucer-like way. And it's pink and long, long, long blooming from late spring into the fall, shorter and than most of the other echinaceas, and absolutely gorgeous, really quite stunning.
So,
those are a few faves.
So one lesson there is there's no single echinacea, a plant that people think is a group of one or three, is in itself a very diverse family.
Absolutely. I'll give you an obscure favorite now, because that was a super popular favorite and a well-known one. I would say that I'm on a campaign to bring out a revival of the wild quinine, or our Parthenium integrifolium. It's got beautiful cream-colored, hard, knobby blossoms that's kind of flat, and it stays in bloom all summer into the fall. Good fresh cut, good dried, and becomes the base for a huge number of arrangements, even a lot of weddings that I've done the design work for. It is absolutely fantastic.
I should add, for mm-hmm. those who are interested in such things, the back of the book features a lot of the weddings that you've supplied the flowers for. Of course, all the brides are beautiful. All brides are beautiful. You show their wedding bouquets, and in many cases, you show exactly how you made those wedding bouquets out of wildflowers for these brides.
What's really cool is that I worked with each of the brides and their group, and I taught them on a DIY basis how to make all the flowers for their own weddings. And in fact, the flowers you see in those pictures, they made, which I think is really awesome. And what happened was, not only did they end up with beautiful flowers that are lovely for a wedding, they learned and they really connected with the wildflowers, and they had a very important, powerful grasp of wildflowers and their place in the gardening world and their own lives.
It is a question that never used to be asked, but mm-hmm. in the last 4 or 5 years, we are deluged all year long with emails from people who either want to grow their own flowers for the surrounding of their wedding, or want to grow their own wedding bouquets and table arrangements, mm-hmm. or both. And they're not asking for suggestions of what they can go out and buy. They want to grow it. They want it to be a part of their experience.
Most people in North America think that wildflowers are something that you just grab a bag or a can of, and it can say any sort of random thing on it. It's a pretty picture on the cover, and you just sort of throw on some Vivaldi and strew flowers left and right, and voila. But in fact, it is much different from that. It's not a difficult process, but it's not that. You are dealing primarily with perennials, so you can't impulsively get engaged in April and then suddenly decide that at the end of August you're going to have the wedding garden of your dreams. You do have to plan ahead. Or more and more, there are lots of wonderful growers in the United States and Canada that are growing local flowers, which I think is a very important thing to do as well. But there are lots of ways that people can work to do DIY weddings with local organic flowers. It's a good idea.
One thing you just mentioned that I remember from my time as editor of Organic Gardening magazine mm-hmm. is there were these national companies selling, quote, wildflower mixes. And we had to warn people mm-hmm. to be cautious, because this wildflower mix not intended for any specific region or any specific climate or USDA growing zone, one, may not give you the kind of results you want, or two, may introduce something that really doesn't belong there.
Exactly. Most of them tend to consist of annuals, a lot of fill, a number of invasives, and rarely, if ever, are they organized by the site conditions, the type of soil, the amount of moisture, the amount of sunlight an area receives, which really is the key. On the Wildflower Farm website, which is the name of my company, we have a selection guide, and you can go onto it. There's a lovely drop box, and you put in your state or your province, and it tells you all the wildflowers and native grasses that are native to your area. Then you cross-reference that with the ones that you know will work in exactly the conditions you've got, and then you've got something that will truly work and that you only have to seed once.
Well, it's obvious that you love your wildflowers. I am sure they love you back. Miriam Goldberger is the author of Taming Wildflowers, a new book subtitled Bringing the Beauty and Splendor of Nature's Blooms into Your Own Backyard. It is published by St. Lynn's Press, and she has two websites, one for the book called TamingWildflowers.com and one for her wildflower farm business, which is called WildflowerFarm.com. Miriam, thanks very much for being on You Bet Your Garden. And now, back to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Ross, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, Mike, how are you today?
I'm doing great, Russ. How are you, sir?
We're doing pretty good.
And where is Russ doing pretty good?
We're in Creston, North Carolina.
What can we do for you, sir?
Well, Mike, we actually have came into a mountain of manure that the people with their horses, they were using wood shavings. And we were wondering if this was going to be something that we could mix in with our compost. We usually do hay with the horse manure, but we have a mountain, I would say, of wood shavings with it. We know it's kind of like mixing good with bad, and we don't want to kill our garden.
Oh, no, no, no.
Best.
There's really not that much difference, man. When you talk about especially chickens, poultry, and horses, the term manure almost always means the combination of the three ingredients, the two things that the animal was done with, to put it delicately.
Right.
And then the bedding that captured it, because as anybody who's kept horses or poultry knows, that when they're in their stalls for the night or in their coops for the night, you need something on the floor to collect this debris to keep things clean, make it easy to sweep out the stables or sweep out the coop, and to keep the floor from becoming slippery for the horses, which is a huge issue. And there's all different types of bedding. But wood shavings are very traditional bedding. And what you wind up getting here is the two components of the manure are very nitrogen rich. And then whatever the bedding is, it's going to be a dry, carbonaceous brown material, whether it's, you know, wood shavings or hay or straw or something like that. Horse manure is a very good activator to break down the material quickly. Now, you say that you have regular compost as well, right?
Yes, we do.
And what do you make that out of?
That we have a chicken farm, so we use our chicken manure, we use horse manure with hay, plus coffee grounds, grass clippings, and lots of leaves, lots of leaves.
Okay, all right. Well, the first thing I'm going to tell you is leave the grass clippings on the lawn.
Right.
That's where they belong. Okay. Coffee grounds are almost redundant because you've got the two most super powerful nitrogen-rich manures in there with the chickens and the horses. And obviously the more shredded leaves, the better. Now, what are you using this to grow nitrogen-feeding crops like a grassland, like sweet corn, potatoes?
No, actually, well, we have a variety, a good chunk of potatoes, peppers, tomatoes. We have five raised beds that we do onions, garlic, lettuce.
Now, most of those sound
kale.
Good to me, but I would always add something to even if we combined all these composted manures, and it doesn't sound like you really make any, quote, compost. It sounds like everything already has manure in it.
Yeah, good bit, except for the leaves, probably, but everything else does.
So I would not overuse this material on fruiting crops, on things like string beans, tomatoes, or peppers. If you give them only the nitrogen rich, it will actually inhibit a number of fruits you get.
Right, yes.
So what I would do is, very early in the composting process, I would introduce rock phosphate. That's a natural mined material you buy in bags. A little goes a huge way. Now, typically, if you're going to apply rock phosphate in the garden, you need to apply it the whole season before because it takes a while to become bioavailable.
Right.
But if it's mixed into a composting process where you've got all these hot manures and all this biological activity, the rock phosphate is just going to mix in there and give you all this available phosphorus, balance it out, and your tomato plants will be normal-sized and have lots of delicious fruits.
Okay, good deal.
Green sand is another great amendment. And again, these minerals, they need time to become bioactive. So I would introduce them into the composting manures when the manures are mixed with the leaf compost. Have everything cooked together by adding those two easily available and not that expensive organic amendments. You'll turn that composted manure into an absolute complete fertilizer.
Super. Thank you, Mike. We appreciate this second time you've helped us, and the first shot works great. So we're constantly listening to you.
All right. Well, that's what we depend on here. Thanks, man. Good luck.
Thanks a lot, Mike. You have a good day. Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I'll appear on March 22nd and 23rd at the Fredericksburg, Virginia Home and Garden Show. On Saturday, March 29th at the Severna Park Home Show in Severna Park, Maryland. And on Sunday, March 30th at the Harford County Home Show in Bel Air, Maryland. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls, how to deal with winter-damaged plants, and just maybe, maybe, just maybe, a silver lining to the miserable cold and icy weather so many of us have endured. I'm miserably cold and icy Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Burpee supports You Bet Your Garden. Burpee can help do the gardening for you with garden-ready plants, tomatoes, peppers, eggplants, herbs, and more, delivered at planting time in your region. These and more can be seen online at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we will get to the question of the week. a triple question of the week about damaged blueberries, storm-damaged trees, and whether there's a silver lining to this terrible weather we've had in terms of putting some insect pests down. We'll tell you all about it after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls. At 1-888-346-9499. Michelle, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi.
Hello, Michelle. How are you?
I'm doing all right. How are you?
I am fine, thank you. And where is Michelle doing all right?
I am in Yellow Springs, Ohio.
Oh, one of our favorite radio stations. We have a great listenership there. They really get involved. Nice to have you with us.
Thank you.
What can we do for you?
Well, I just had a question about doing hanging tomato plants.
Hanging these upside-down tomato plants, if you look at them, one of the things we talk about all the time is if you want to grow the really flavorful tomatoes, the vines grow 10 or 12 mm-hmm. feet long, which is why I go into detail about how to cage them without mm-hmm. using up that much linear space. How are you going to hang this thing so that the vine has...
Well, my thought was just off of our porch, because we tried to do tomatoes last year, and our porch, I don't think it gets enough sun. The whole yard just really doesn't get enough sun, and so I was thinking maybe if they were elevated that they would get more sun.
You mean by growing them 12 feet higher in shade, somehow being closer to the sun is going to, like, give them a non-brown aura?
Maybe.
No. Another problem with these things is if you look at the bag that the roots are in, it doesn't even look like it holds a quart of soil. You know, tomatoes are big, rangy plants, and they really need a lot of soil around their roots, and they need a lot of room to grow. And that they are really not meant to grow upside down. All plants really want to reach up towards the sun. Even vines, like tomatoes, which is why if you grow them inside a 5 or 6 foot high cage, but you don't support the vine will wrap itself around the inside of the cage, and by the time it gets to the top, will have used up 8 or 10 feet of that magnificent length. So you can have a normal size garden footprint, and you can grow one of these real big monster vines. Now, you had no success last year because you don't have enough sun.
Well, that's what I thought it was, but after scouring your tomato pages last week, I think it might have just been the wilts.
Well, soil-borne wilts only occur after you've grown tomatoes in the same spot year after year.
Okay.
And tell me how you grew them. Did you buy starts? Did you try to start your own seed?
Yeah, we bought starts from a local farmer and put them in big buckets.
In buckets?
Not buckets, vases, big vases outside, the ceramic kind, and with lots of soil. And
where did you get your soil?
From the same guy. We got a, you know, partial compost. I'm not entirely sure. We got some tomatoes, but then it was shortly after, you know, they had their full first popping out of tomatoes, then they just started dying from the bottoms up, and the leaves would turn yellow and then wilt, and I would take off anything that started turning yellow mm-hmm. and hope if it was a disease that would stop it.
But they started wilting and turning yellow down low, and it progressed up the plant.
Uh-huh.
And then, but the top of the plant, the very top of the plant, while this is happening, still looks nice and healthy.
Was still producing, yeah.
Yeah, that sure sounds like... Now, when you bought this soil from this farmer, was it bulk or was it professionally bagged or...
You know, it was bagged, so it wasn't like a local...
But it wasn't bagged with like a national brand or anything?
I don't remember. I just know it was an organic soil.
Well, there's no such thing. You know, if you go to our website and read a Garden Answers A to Z, the topsoil and compost definitions will raise a lot of your eyebrows. Now, you say your containers were ceramic, like terracotta or glazed?
Terracotta.
Okay. Did they have good drainage?
I think so. I didn't have them inside any dish pans.
And how big are these containers?
A few gallons, at least.
And what kind of tomatoes were you growing? Do you remember any variety names, any types?
I want to say, like, one type of cherry, I think a brandy wine.
And the same thing happened to all of them?
Yeah, though they didn't all start at the same time.
That's okay. And about how much sun do you honestly think they get?
The sun on that side of the deck probably gets there at 10.
Really?
It's okay. Sun until sunset.
Okay, no, so 10 a.m. till sunset. All right. I would dump out that soil. I would not use that soil again. There, hopefully you have like a landscape where you can use it around other plants and stuff, but I would not use it to try to grow tomatoes again. I would use really big pots. I'd like 17-inch pots for each tomato plant to make sure they have plenty of root growth. And you need to go out and find a good independent garden center or nursery. Get a big bag of soil-free mix. Get some high-quality compost. Mix them half and half. Make sure the pots have good drainage. They have to drain well. And then put them in that sunny spot. But the nice thing about you growing in containers is once you dump that soil out and just wash it out, just with plain water, soap and water, don't use anything terrible like bleach, and refill them with a real good container mix, 10 hours of sun a day up on a deck, you should be able to grow great tomatoes.
Okay.
But it sounds like you got bad soil.
I guess.
Well, no, because the symptoms you describe are the symptoms of what in your region would be verticillium wilt. But since you didn't grow tomatoes in that soil beforehand, somebody did, it sounds like. What I would suggest, that to go to our website, click on Garden Answers A to Z, read growing tomatoes in containers. Follow the rules, and I suspect the successes in your future.
All right. Thank you.
All right. My pleasure. Good luck. 1-888-346-9499. Dolores, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Well, thank you for making it, Dolores. How are you?
I'm fine. And I recognize your name from Organic Gardening magazine from a long time ago.
It is a long time ago now. I was the editor from 1991 through 1997.
Okay.
Where are you, Dolores?
In Franklin Park, New Jersey. It's central New Jersey between New Brunswick and Princeton.
That's a nice area there. What can we do for Dolores in central New Jersey?
I've had a garden for many years, but since they built a development down the road, all the groundhogs have moved up to our area, and there's woods behind us, and no matter what I've tried, I can't grow my garden anymore. They kill it every time.
You know, that is not an uncommon problem. It's a well-known phenomenon that when they take a wooded area and tear out the woods and put in a development, that groundhogs go in search of new territory. What have you tried to protect it?
Okay, I put up a 4-foot-high fence. That didn't work.
No.
So I had somebody dig all around it because it's a pretty large garden. And I put in an underground fence that goes down 18 inches and out 18 inches.
Okay.
That didn't, nothing. And I tried electrifying the fence, and I don't know that that ever worked at all, the battery, you know.
Okay. Okay.
And then I put another 4-foot fence on top of it, and they kind of pry their way in between the two fences. Mm-hmm. They're very stubborn.
Yes, and during all this time, though, you did not go to our website, did you?
I didn't know about it.
Oh, okay. If you had gone to youbetyourgarden.org and looked under the Garden Answers A to Z, under G for groundhogs, you would have seen what we call our critter control fence design that keeps them out, but it has to be done exactly right. And you start with fencing that is 6 feet in height. And as you did after the fact, you dig a trench and you just go straight down 18 inches. You just put the fence down 18 inches because putting it laterally doesn't help. You want them to hit a physical barrier as they continue to dig. You want it to come up about 3 feet on the outside. And then you want to make sure that the fence is strongly staked so that 3 feet is really solid. But then you have to take that extra foot and a half, and bend it outward like a baffle.
Oh.
Because as you have noticed, groundhogs are excellent climbers.
Mm-hmm.
You would think that those fat, furry little butts wouldn't be able to get up a fence, but they are really good at it because they have these powerful claws. But what happens is if you have the top portion of the fence bent outwards and unsupported as a baffle, do you know what I mean? Like a 90-degree angle going away from the garden?
Right.
They climb up the outside. They get to this baffle. They start to go out it, and then the baffle drops them down on their furry little rear end. You said you tried to back end an electrified fence?
It was a battery-powered electric fence.
Well, with a groundhog, typically just a couple of wires, I believe, one at 6 inches off the ground and one at 18 inches off the ground, is all you need to keep them out. And then you can have a couple of wires higher up for deer. Now, although deer will jump 8 feet, when they're walking up to a garden, they lean into these fences. And the smart money says to buy one of these new kits that's solar-powered. You get a solar charger, and it comes, it's all wired together into the fence. You face the solar charger south. And because it is solar-powered, the shock is very controlled. It's a very mild shock. It's just enough to get their attention and not to hurt them.
Mm-hmm.
But it is enough to keep them away. Go to our website, go to Garden Answers A to Z, look under groundhogs, look under fencing, and it'll walk you through the design of the fence.
Okay.
All right, good luck, Dolores.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, as promised, it's time for the question of the week. Winter damage. Can this plant be saved? Alexis Landis, producer of You Bet Your Garden, read the first of this week's many questions.
Well, Mike, we've been overwhelmed with questions about plants damaged by the wretched winter most of the country has suffered through. In fact, if I hear the words polar vortex one more time, I'm going to snap.
You're going to snap? I thought you already did. Remember? Back when that third ice storm in a row turned all our driveways into skating rinks and you did that unassisted triple Lutz? Anyway, let's make with the questions, or I'm going to use the I word again.
No, anything but that. Charlie in Nashville writes, here in the Mid-South, we've experienced less snow and ice than you, but just as frigid temperatures, some in the single digits. I planted garlic cloves in October, as always, about an inch and a half deep. In the past, this has worked very well, but this year the tops have died back, leaving just a little bit of green above ground. Are they going to produce, or do I need to plant some more as soon as the ground softens?
Well, absolutely no to the replanting. Although some sources will tell you otherwise, I would only ever plant garlic in the fall. Now, no matter what kind of winter you typically have, Charlie, your garlic is as shallow as I am. You should always place the bottom of the clove about 6 inches below the soil line so that the bulbs have lots of room to grow fat and happy. Now, I have had these kind of winters before, and my garlic has always survived. With any luck, yours is going to perk up in the spring. Remember, we're all a little browned out this winter. If you want to help the plant, spread an inch of compost over top, you know, to try to imitate a deeper planting.
And to continue your streak of answering every question with compost?
You're looking a little winter damaged over there. Maybe you could use some.
We also heard from Jennifer in Malvern, Pennsylvania. An especially harsh winter storm damaged many trees on our property, and a wild cherry limb completely crushed my well-established blueberry bushes. They were 4 to 5 feet tall, have been on the property for over 30 years, still produce well and require little care. Can these bushes be saved? The limb, about 12 inches in diameter, is not completely detached from the tree, but with so many other trees affected, this one is not a priority to remove, especially while we still have so much snow and ice on the ground. We do most of our own tree work. Once we can get the limb off, what is the next step? Do we prune the bushes now to cut out the damaged branches? Do we just wait and see what happens in the spring? Will spring ever come?
Oh, don't share their hysteria, honey. Now, damaged tree branches should always be removed as quickly as possible for the health of the remaining tree. So this may be a situation where some hired help is necessary, especially if it ensures repairing damage to your savable trees while we're still in the dormant period, when trees can handle the most aggressive pruning. And if I personally had great old blueberry bushes that had a huge branch crushing them, I'd make it a super number one priority to carve it up and get it out of there before I did anything else. Again, to seize the benefit of dormancy, which the blueberries are also in.
And then what? Immediate pruning? Maybe some compost?
You know, you're lucky there's laws against shredding your producer and mixing her up with coffee grounds. Anyway, no. Just get that limb off and then leave the poor things alone until they start to green up again in the spring. Plants that big and old are going to have a lot of inherent energy down in their root systems, and I suspect that none of them are going to be really most sincerely dead. So prune away all of the dead and severely damaged branches after what's still alive has made itself obvious. Then give them a good inch of milled peat moss to reacidify their soil.
And
cover the peat moss with an inch of compost to give them a gentle feeding.
I knew it.
All right. Our listener may not get much fruit this summer, but she may well get more than average in the years to come from this accidental rejuvenation hard pruning.
And finally, we heard from Joe in Hagerstown, Maryland, who's hoping for a silver lining. He writes, does this stretch of zero temps and heavy snow cover mean fewer insect pests this summer?
I expect so, Joe. Mosquitoes, for instance, overwinter in the adult stage, and they do best in warm winters. This miserable one should cut their numbers severely. And the woolly adelgid, the white furry aphid that's been decimating hemlocks, requires warm winters to thrive.
So good news for hemlocks.
Double good news, as they suffer when winter doesn't get cold enough. And so they were on their last legs following this recent stretch of warm ones. The weather that made us so miserable this year may well have given this entire species a second chance. Well, that sure was a hopeful look at our poor, beleaguered, winter-damaged plants, now wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to leave large limbs lying on my lumbar if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org.
Please, please tell us where you live. Please, please.
And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you'll find answers to all your garden questions, audio of this show, past show, and our podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week is Kevin, don't call me Merv Griffin. Rich Banowitz and Sarah Kazar are You Bet Your Garden's internet illuminators. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Our editor is Al Banks. Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Sing along as we thank our production assistant, Marissa Nicosia, for her fine work on the show. Nicosia, Nicosia! I'm vocally challenged, winter-damaged Mike McGrath. But, you know, maybe I'll just spread an inch of compost around my base and gain the strength to see you again next week. The magnificent monarch may be fighting extinction. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll discuss the plants you can install and simple landscape changes you can make to help this beautiful butterfly beat the odds. Plus your fabulous phone calls.